I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Some research published almost 20 years ago by Betty Hart and Todd Risley is still pretty shocking. They taped and then counted the words spoken to children in 40 families that ranged from rich to poor. The children in poor families heard approximately 600 words an hour, while the children in more well-off families heard 2,100 words an hour. Add that up, and by the age of four, poor kids literally heard 35 million fewer words than kids in well-to-do families during those formative years. Well, today on Radio Times, we're going to take a look at the important role that language plays in a child's development and what can be done to reduce this word gap. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Trudy Hecker is a pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, is the medical director for quality improvement and the medical director for Reach Out and Read. And Trudy Hecker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Roberta Golenkoff, and she's the H. Rodney Sharp Chair in the School of Education at the University of Delaware, and is also a member in the Departments of Psychology and Linguistics, and also directs the Infant Language Project. And Roberta Golenkoff, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks.
Nice to have you both here. I have to say, the more reading I did for this show, the more it got me to think of just how unique, first of all, language is, speaking is to the human race. That is one thing that sets us apart. But also the complicated process that goes on for children to acquire language. And I'm wondering whether it starts, for instance, in utero.
Absolutely. There's a recent study by Patricia Kuhl at the University of Washington that shows that babies learn the vowels of their native language in the womb. And there's also research that suggests that babies can remember stories and songs they heard in the womb. Now, that doesn't mean that people should run out and spend $400 on a pregophone.
And such a thing exists.
No. That stuff does exist, yes. And the marketplace is really ruling how we treat our kids and what we think about our kids, which is why it's so fabulous, Marty, that you're having today's show. Because parents really need to know what the scoop is, and the marketplace doesn't always tell them the truth.
Well, I'm wondering, just picking up on what you said, you know, as you said, you don't have to run out and spend a lot of money, but just be aware that as you're talking, as you're living your life, this growing baby is hearing things.
That's right. And all you need to do is narrate your daily activities at first, even before the baby talks to you. The baby is doing so much in the first year of life. It's incredible. I just spoke to the American Academy of Audiologists in Anaheim, California. And the reason I spoke to them is when babies are deaf, they are increasingly getting what's called cochlear implants that enable them to hear and grow up like typical kids. But they're getting their implants now at the age of a year, and they wanted the audiologist to know how much goes on in that first year of life that the kids who get the cochlear implants at a year have to catch up on. It's amazing the things that kids can do in the first year.
Well, let me go to you. You're a pediatrician, so you spend a lot of time with babies in that first year of life. I'd be curious about, since we're talking about language and what babies hear and what they're perhaps even mimicking, take us into your world.
Yes, so I have the opportunity to examine kids in the examination rooms here at CHOP, and we actually really talk a lot about the importance of development and early childhood interactions with children. So I'll walk into the room and really begin to talk to the baby, talk to the mother, try to catch that baby's eyes, and while I'm examining, I'm really modeling for the parents the importance of interacting. I'm talking about what I'm doing, I'm commenting on everything as we go through the exam, you know, and then we give some recommendations, anticipatory guidance, and part of that anticipatory guidance is always about development, nutrition, safety, but really highlighting the developmental aspects of that first year of life. It's an amazing process to watch babies beginning to speak, not only with their
bodies.
Exactly, moving their arms and getting excited about things and really showing parents that importance. My face in the baby's face and the mother modeling that as well. So we're very excited about that opportunity. Pediatricians have that unique opportunity. We see those babies at 2 days, 1 month, 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year. So we see them a lot. And hopefully we can be that steady influence in that family's life.
And are you saying, oh, and look at this little
Absolutely.
I mean, you're using the kind of baby talk that we...
Yes, we call it mother ease. We absolutely model that, particularly in some of our offices where there are a lot of young urban families maybe teenage moms that really don't feel the license that they can begin to talk in baby talk. They're really trying so hard to be grown up. And actually, I go in there and model just exactly what I said. Look at how happy he is. Look at how great this is. Yes! And modeling. And babies are just, you know, that 2 to 4 month to 6 month range, they're happy, they're smiling, they're really engaged. And so they have no stranger anxiety. So I can really model for the mother right there in the context of the office.
Why does baby talk, why does that work with babies?
So think about what we do when we talk to a baby, Marty. You know, you look at this baby and your face lights up and you speak in this exaggerated, high-pitched manner, which you were just doing, Trudy.
Exactly.
It was a great imitation of baby talk.
Exactly.
And babies like to hear the high frequency. Turns out pitch drives a lot of this. But remember, it's accompanied by these faces. In fact, somebody did a study just showing the faces, and babies prefer to look at faces that are doing baby talk than adult-directed speech. So in my lab, people often ask or say, I don't do baby talk. I don't think it's good for them. And I'm so happy to be able to say, well, you probably can't help yourself. And it's a good thing that that's true. Because, for example, we did a study that came out 2 years ago about how babies learned novel words better when they heard infant-directed speech than when they heard adult-directed speech. So it really does make a difference.
So if you hold a baby's hand and say, this is your hand.
Right.
I mean, that would be more effective than saying, this is your hand.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And baby talk is also accompanied by a lot of repetition.
Yes.
And you follow the baby's lead, and you're more likely to say things that the baby is interested in. You're looking at the baby's gaze at first and establishing what we call joint attention with the baby. So one of the things that it's so important for parents to know, and I wish we could spread the word, is that babies are not eggplants. And I wrote with Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, my colleague at Temple, a Huffington Post piece called that, because they look like blobs. They're just sitting there in the first year of life. Okay, maybe they smile, maybe they vocalize, but there are many people who don't appreciate how much is going on in that little head. And that's why they need us, because we provide that stimulation for them. We give them that grist for their mill, because they're pulling out regularities in the language around them. And if they don't hear language, they can't do it, and they'll be behind.
Right. Well, it's interesting, Trudy, because you talked about the importance of eye contact.
Yes.
It's not just sort of blabbing at these little babies. It's really interacting with them, isn't it?
It's absolutely. And reciprocity is really what you're looking for. So the baby's making some motions and talking to you, and you're talking back. And you can model that very easily in the short time you have with the child in the office. We also have what's called Reach Out and Read, which is our early literacy program. And we have that in 47 sites across the city of Philadelphia. And we actually bring in the book into the exam room. So I walk into my visit with a family beginning at 6 months and at every well-child visit through 5 years of age with a book. And I can tell you, when I walk in with a book for that six-month-old, that baby's sitting on the mother's lap, and I'm able to go in with the book, open that book, show the baby the pictures. That is such a teachable moment for our families, because that baby's eyes light up, starts to smile, pat the book, may even put it in his mouth, so that oral motor phenomenon that is also so important of this. I get to model to the mom, look at how smart your baby is. This baby sees. He's very interested in what you're talking about. And then that just continues a conversation that we continue to have at every checkup until the child is 5 years of age. As the child grows, we then begin to add more instruction, modeling, like what is the picture about, what does the cow say, those kinds of things. And we pick books specifically for babies. So the first few books that we have are the books of baby faces. Babies love to look at faces, as Roberta said. And so we have lots of books with faces, and then lots of interaction books where they have the ability to look at cows and animals and all kinds of themes, so that the kid has exposure to words that they wouldn't otherwise have.
I'm curious also, because you mentioned the fact that if you're working with a teenage mom, and perhaps they feel like, you know, I'm too cool for baby talk, but you have to convince them that that talking in that high-pitched, sing-songy way is not going to be embarrassing.
No, exactly. And you're using that book as the tool that the parent can then, that mother can go home with, so she can practice some more with that. We're talking about sharing the book. You don't have to read it. It's play. It's about interacting with the baby. That's what's so crucial about this. And it gives them license. And I can then give that mother positive feedback. great job. Look at how wonderful you're doing. He really loves this book. Isn't that terrific? So we hope we're modeling as well as giving advice.
Let me go back to this study, Roberta, which is, I mean, the study is almost 20 years old, but nonetheless, this word, literal deficit between more well-off kids, probably kids of more well-off educated parents, and poor kids, that by the time these kids are 4 or 5 years old, they just have not been exposed to millions of words that their more well-off counterparts have.
So I would emphasize that what that study did was it looked at the speech addressed to kids, because in a lot of homes today, an increasing number, the television is on 24 hours a day. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yes.
Oh, my God. So it's not television that's helping these kids. It's the speech that's directed to children. So at the end of the period, the children who heard less language knew far fewer vocabulary items than the children who heard more language and had lower IQs, because IQ is 50% verbal and 50% motor kinds of activities. And the only reason I mention IQ is because IQ correlates highly with success in school. So what that means is, if you were at the bottom end of that distribution and you weren't hearing a lot of language, it's sad to say this, but essentially you're being set up for school failure, because you're not hearing the language that you hear. You're not acquiring the concept. So think about what you do when you use language. It's not, you're not just babbling. You're actually teaching a kid something. So you see a kid looks in the sky when they see an airplane, and you say to them, oh, that's an airplane. People can get in there, and they can fly. And remember, we went on an airplane when we went to see Grandma, whatever. You're teaching children concepts. Mm-hmm. So it's not just language. It's what language conveys.
Well, we're almost up in a break here, about a minute away from our break here. But is it? But how much does things like do things like tone work? I'm thinking about the content of words, but if it's delivered, you know, sit down.
Yeah. Yeah,
That's going to have a different effect on a child than a more conversational tone.
Well, it's good you say that in the context of the Hart and Risley study, because they also looked at the nature of the language used. And the higher socioeconomic status families used many more encouragements and positive statements like, good job, try that again, oh, you can do that. Whereas the lower socioeconomic status families gave more directions and said more things that were negative, like, stop that, don't do that, come here. We know from the research that giving commands and not asking questions hurts children's language, and it makes perfect sense. Imagine you were learning a second language and you're in a classroom, right? And the teacher never gives you an opportunity to talk. She just keeps giving you orders, you know, walk to the left, walk to the right, right? As opposed to saying, would you like to walk to the left or the right? Then you have to articulate. You have to say something. You have to put a sentence together. You have to think. So the whole goal is getting kids to think. And if you're giving them orders and just commands, they don't have that opportunity.
We are talking about language, words, and our guests, Trudy Hecker and Roberta Golenkoff. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School with day and residential options is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Dr. Dan Gottlieb makes a presentation at their Phoenixville campus on April 22nd, and the school hosts an open house at their Glenmore campus on April 27th. To register for the presentation on April 22nd and the open house on April 27th, and for more details, camphillspecialschool.org.
Just you wait. WHYY's program about popular culture brings you stories about our changing world, like trying to stop teenagers from ruining their digital lives, practical tips to ready yourself for the end of days, and how we sent one of our reporters to space camp and it nearly killed him. Okay, he just blacked out a little. Still, pretty cool. Those stories and more, just you wait.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Princeton Medicine proudly supports WHYY. Princeton Medicine brings together primary care physicians, specialists, and surgeons from throughout central New Jersey to help provide greater access and coordinated care. Their specialties range from cardiology and geriatrics to cancer care, obstetrics and gynecology, and more. To find a Princeton Medicine doctor, 1-800-FIND-A-DR. That's FINDADR. Or online at findadr.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about why it's important to talk with and to your baby and your young child, critical for their developing brains. Our researchers are knowing more and more about how words, the number of words that a parent or an adult uses with a child really matters. Our guests are Roberta Golenkoff. She's the H. Rodney Sharp Chair in the School of Education at the University of Delaware, where she directs the Infant Language Project. Also with us, Trudy Hecker. She's a pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, medical director for quality improvement, and medical director for Reach Out and Read, which she was describing for us. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. During the break, we were talking about TV. And Trudy, I want to give you a chance to talk about that. Some advice that you give to parents, I guess, of young children.
Yes, yeah, so I've begun to ask my families in the context of the checkup, how many of you have TVs, how many TVs do you have in the home, and do you have a TV in the child's bedroom? And it has been remarkable to hear how many families actually have TVs in the child's bedroom. So we've really been trying to encourage families to have that removed from the bedroom. It's quite stimulating. There's frequent commercials, so the attention span for the child is quite a problem, as well as we know that TV is not a replacement for one-on-one interactions with another adult, a sibling. And so as we give the books out in our checkups, mm-hmm. we are also encouraging families to turn off that TV. Really, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no screen time under the age of 2 and limiting it to 1 to 2 hours over the age of 2. And so we want to be careful of that and really encourage families to avoid the stimulating nature of TV. Roberta can comment on that.
Yeah, and I'm curious about why, I mean, if there are a lot of words that come out of that
of
box.
Words, right.
Why is that not the same as an adult or a parent talking with a child?
It's not directed to the child. And what you want to talk about, and there's actually research that shows this, is if you talk about what the child is looking at and interested in, the child is much more likely to learn the
exactly.
word that's in question than if you talk about something you're interested in and try to pull the child's attention away from mm-hmm. their interest to yours. Television doesn't take into account what the kid is doing. It's all about the contingency mm-hmm. between my interests, if I'm the baby, and what the parent says to me. That's what helps me learn language. And having the television on disrupts children's play, even when children aren't watching television.
Just on in the background.
Yes. So television is a problem, and I wish that we could get it out of kids' bedrooms, because they really don't need that.
Right.
Think about this, too. When children are watching television, just as Trudy pointed out, what is it that it's replacing? It's replacing fantasy play with peers, play with friends, play with mom or dad.
Yes.
And they're their children's best teacher, and that's where kids learn language, from interacting with all these groups, as opposed to watching a television. Now, that said, you know, Sesame Street is pretty darn good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we know kids can learn from it. But in some families, they're not discriminating what kinds of things are on the screen,
right.
and they're actually, talk of stimulating this, shocking and inappropriate content
like
that children are around.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah, we rarely encourage parents to sit with a child when they're watching Sesame Street and really begin to talk. So that adds an extra layer to the interaction.
Absolutely.
So that you're sitting there. It's great to watch Sesame Street, but you mm-hmm. want to talk about what's happening on the TV so that that interaction doesn't get lost in the process.
Can we say, I mean, does the research say, Roberta, that this gap in language acquisition and even this word gap, that really might be a partial explanation for the achievement gap that we see in schools?
Absolutely. Because if you think about it, at the beginning, you learn to read. Now, when you learn to read, you have to decode, you have to know the names of the letters, the sounds, etc. That's not really the hard part. The hard part is what happens at grade 3 or 4 when kids hit the wall.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they hit the wall is now learning to read has turned into reading to learn. And if you don't have the vocabulary and if you don't have the world knowledge that the books have in their texts,
yes.
it's going to be really hard for you to understand the material.
Huh.
Reading is not only important for reading qua reading, but a huge amount of the variability in how children do in math is a product of how much language they have. Think about the words more, less, plus, equal. You have to know what those words mean. So if people are playing number games with you when you're a kid at home, you're more likely to come to school prepared. And if people talk to you more about the kinds of things you're going to learn about in school and tell you stories, you're going to know something about the structure of narrative. Yes. Narrative is what you find in children's books. How are you going to know that a story has a beginning, a middle, and an end of various types, right? If people don't engage with you and read with you.
That's exactly our goal for Reach Out and Read, because we're giving a book to the child at every checkup, so they leave with a library. By the time they're five, they have a library of 10 books, and if they're siblings, maybe 30 books or 40, depending on how many kids are in the family. And it's that goal of sort of talking about the book, talking about asking those dialogic reading questions, which is, tell us the what's happening. What do you think is happening? Who's that? Point to the cow. What does the cow say? Exactly. Those kinds of questions are really what prepare children for kindergarten. Think about the difference between my child, who we read to from the time he was little, to a child that hasn't had that experience of touching a book, knowing which way a book is put upright, and the beginning, middle, and end, as Roberta said. So that's why we are so passionate about this.
But are we talking about brain development here, Roberta? Are we really talking about that this kind of stimulation and exposure to words and language and reading, that affects this growing child's brain?
Everything that we do impacts on brain development. But we don't need the research on brain development to tell us how important it is. The stuff Trudy just talked about is so right on. And she used the term dialogic reading, which is just exactly the kind of stuff middle-class parents do with their kids without thinking. They say, and what color is his outfit? You know, stuff like this. When you ask kids questions and when you link it up to their lives and you say, oh, Nana has a dog like that, right? You make a book come alive. That's what reading is about. And that's what makes kids love reading. Yes. So when I speak around the country, what I say is, do not teach manners when you read. Because reading and telling the kid essentially to shut up and listen is not
absolutely not.
Will advantage your child. The time to teach manners is at other occasions. When you read, you want to follow the little pointing finger to wherever it goes, and you want to take the child's interest into consideration.
Absolutely.
That will build vocabulary and another kind of sentence structure that's found in school. Academic language appears more likely in books. So I read recently a child went poof and then they disappeared, right? Now nobody talks like that, right? He got that because he'd been read to a lot and he was used to that genre. That will help him when he gets to books in school.
You know, I'm also thinking, I mean, I think there's no argument here about the importance of reading and hearing language and interacting with adults, but I'm also thinking, Trudy, about at least some poor families where, let's say, you've got, a working mom and dad who maybe have more than one job trying to cobble together an income for the family. They might be taking public transportation, getting back and forth.
Yes.
That there's a lot of stresses on families, and you can almost understand why that TV or just, I don't have time to read to you, why that could happen.
Yes. It is understandable. There's no question about it. You know, our families work very hard to try to get access just to health care for their kids. So that is definitely a piece of it. But I think by the pediatrician embracing this and using us, I hate to call this our bully pulpit, but in that
sense, it is what
we are able to sort of imbue upon the family, that how important this is. I talk about how I read to my own children. Use that time on the bus. They're going to be on the bus. Take the book with you. You're leaving with the tool. What we also do in all our centers is have gently used books so that the siblings who are coming with can take a book. We collect books from all over the region, and we have extra books in the exam rooms as well so that the siblings, everybody leaves with a book. No question about it. And then the mom can use those downtimes, a few minutes that she has. It doesn't have to be specifically at nighttime. We talk about it being a nice nighttime routine because it winds down children, the four B's.
Their parents as well.
Exactly. And it becomes a very useful way to help with sleep time. And that's another big issue for many of our families because they're overstimulated. And the TV, again, works against you there. So using that quiet time before bed is a nice time to encourage parents to read.
Go ahead, Roberta.
So I'm glad that you mentioned sleep, because everybody talks about obesity, but sleep is going to become increasingly an issue on our radar. Children who take naps and children who have regular bedtimes are better off because during the time that they're sleeping, they are consolidating their learning.
A deep sleep, right?
Yes.
Or a good sleep.
Yes. And we know this now from the research. Mm-hmm. If you expose babies, and this happens to be a piece of research in the literature by Rebecca Gomez, you expose babies to a pattern of nonsense syllables, be, da, go, la, like that over and over again, and you give half the babies a nap and half the babies no nap, the babies who've had a nap will come back and remember the structure and will have pulled out what the three-syllable nonsense words were that were being repeated in that stretch, whereas the babies who don't have a nap don't pull it out. So we know how important, and I think a lot of people don't realize this, that it's so important to have regular nap times and regular bedtimes. This is actually part of children's learning, and part of why low SES children may not do as well in school is because they don't have these opportunities that more structured households have.
Is it also good to go goo goo gaga ba ba la la? I mean, all of that as well. Is that helpful?
Sure, it's helpful, but you really want to be talking about what you're doing. I think that's what the most important thing is, to really just, it's not anything earth-shattering. It's just talking about what you're doing. Right now, we're going to change your diaper. We're going to, let's see what those legs are like. You're kicking your legs. I mean, any kind of stimulation like that is really what you want to give parents license to do, and to really engage with them. If you we give the books because that becomes the jumping-off point. It's not about spending time getting ABCs, getting colors per se, although that's very helpful. Right. It's really about that interaction with the child, talking about things, sharing stories. That one-on-one is really what's going to get you where you need to be. I mean, children who've been given books have a six-month advantage by two in their language milestones. Mm-hmm. 4 months expressively and 6 months receptively. So we know that books make a difference. And language is the best predictor of later outcome. So we're really aiming for children to have excellent acquisition of language skills.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I know you want to say something, Roberta, but the voice you just heard is Trudy Hecker. She's a pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, the medical director of Reach Out and Read. Roberta Golenkoff is the H. Rodney Sharp Chair in the School of Education at the University of Delaware, directs the Infant Language Project. We are talking about the importance of talking with your children, reading with your children and to your children, the importance of that interaction between parent and child. For quality of life, for achievement later in school, all that good stuff. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Roberta, I know you wanted to say something. Did I just distract you?
I'm trying to remember now.
Well, you know what? Hold on to that thought. Let me get Michelle from Glenmore to join our conversation. And Michelle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. I'm calling about something I've just observed. I'm a 50-year-old mother who has already, my kids are grown, but just seeing this phenomenon where young parents are on the phone all the time when I'm out, talking on cell phones, and they have young toddlers, and I just find it really kind of alarming, and I feel kind of sad for these kids because, you're in a doctor's office waiting room. That's where I used to sit and read or, do puzzles or just in the grocery store and have them in the cart talking. And and they're talking on the cell phone and not really paying a whole lot of attention. And I'm just wondering if you guys see this a lot or, has anybody looked at this as kind of something that's happening? It just seems to happen across, different socioeconomic statuses. It's pretty much everywhere that I'm out and about. I just happen to notice a lot. So I'm just wondering what your comments and thoughts on that are.
It's a good question. I have to say that both of our guests are vigorously nodding their heads. I'm going to toss it to you, Roberta. Thanks, Michelle.
So, Michelle, you are so right on. And if you look at families today, you can even see commercials on television like this. Every individual in the family is on a different electronic device. So what does this mean for kids? It may be the case that the stuff that Trudy and I are talking about is no longer going to be an issue for just low socioeconomic status parents because middle-class parents, as you say, this cuts across the board, seem to be speaking less to
their
children.
Really?
Well, I don't have the data to support this, but I do have the data to tell you that in a word learning experiment conducted at Temple University by Jessa Reed with Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, my colleague, we know now that when a mom is interrupted with a cell phone call, that baby will not learn the word she's trying to teach. The baby will learn the word if the cell phone call comes at the end, but not in the middle.
Because it's
of
interrupting
the teaching
this
episode.
Process?
Yes, and the kid turns off. So it's really important that people recognize this and that when they're with their children, they turn their attention to their children. Their children get nothing from overhearing conversations between adults on the telephone. Yeah. What they need is that one-to-one interaction that Trudy was talking about before.
Michelle, yes. Thanks for the call. Trudy, you want to add to that?
I couldn't agree more. I think it's very true. We see it even in our offices, mm-hmm. and we really try to take the time to encourage parents when you're out running errands, use that opportunity. You know, when you're in the grocery store and the kid's in the cart, just as you said, talk about the eggplant. Talk about its purple. Right. Talk about the fact that
you're not an eggplant, but
exactly.
Here is an eggplant.
Exactly. So I think we keep encouraging families, but I agree, it's worrisome.
So I love what you just said. Going to the supermarket can give children learning opportunities.
Absolutely.
Now, low socioeconomic status parents often believe that the stuff you buy, this is the marketplace shaping how we treat our kids, the stuff you buy, like the Einstein videos, make the difference for children. In fact, the research shows children do not learn words from these videos.
Yes.
A study by Judy Deloche at the University of Virginia has documented that when children watch these videos, even when they watch with a parent sitting with them, they will not learn the words compared to the way they learn words when they're actually interacting in a one-on-one way with a parent.
Right.
Now, low socioeconomic status parents often do not talk to children in supermarkets the way that middle-class parents do. And Catherine Ridge from our labs, my lab at the University of Delaware and Kathy's, did a study putting signs up in supermarkets. And a sign like, what other kinds of apples are there? Look at this red one, you know. And asking parents to read the signs very implicitly, no one coming over to them or anything, increases low socioeconomic status parents' language.
And As a reminder? Or something, here's a way that you can use this experience?
Yes, I think it may not, you know, it depends on how you think about kids. If you think it's really important to talk to your kids, even implicitly, like Judy points out, you know, in your middle class, you're going to do this in the supermarket. And in fact, the signs don't affect the middle class families. They continue to talk the same amount. But if you're preoccupied, we just talked about all the problems that low socioeconomic status parents can have. And if you have a different kind of ideology of childhood and don't realize how important this early stimulation is, you may not take the supermarket as an opportunity to talk to your child. So if you see signs that are obviously directed at you and your child points to them, you will engage your child in more talk and more positive talk.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Roberta Golenkoff, the voice you just heard, and Trudy Hecker. We're talking about language and words, the importance of talking with children, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to talk about girls and boys after this very short break, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Sony Classics, The Company You Keep, a new thriller directed by and starring Robert Redford, with Shia LaBeouf and Susan Sarandon about one man's journey to outrun the FBI and his radical past, starts Friday.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Nicholas McGeegan leads members of the Philadelphia Orchestra in music of Bach, featuring four acclaimed Brandenburg concertos. Brandenburg tickets are available now at 215-893-1999 or online, philorc.org. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Bach's Brandenburg Concertos with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Most baseball fans joke about baseball as a religion, but if you look at it closely, there is significant overlap. Faith and doubt, miracles, blessings and curses, and community. on the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, exploring the connections between America's so-called favorite pastime and religion with John Sexton, author of Baseball as a Road to God, today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking about some at least seemingly simple advice to parents. Talk to your baby. Talk to your toddlers. I guess talk to your children their whole lives. Yeah. It's certainly critical for cognitive and emotional development early on. Researchers have found that exposure to language has many payoffs, including higher achievement in school, more curiosity in the world, the ability to interact with each other. But unfortunately, there is a pronounced language gap for youngsters in this country, and many poor children hear just many fewer words than kids growing up in middle class and well-to-do families. And that's what we're talking about with our guests Trudy Hecker and Roberta Golenkoff, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I said Trudy right before the break we were going to talk about girls and boys, and what I learned during the break is not much difference there, right?
Not really, no. There's not much difference in language acquisition between girls and boys. I think parents are more interested in engaging girls sometimes, but there's not any data that I'm aware of, and Roberta can speak to that probably more clearly than I can.
And whether adults or parents talk to their boys differently than their girls, or has anyone looked at that?
You know, we're all a member of the human species, and there's going to be more overlap than there is difference between boys and girls. Mm-hmm. In fact, girls start out a little bit ahead, but you know, boys are right in there. So the differences don't seem to fall out with respect to gender, but they do seem to fall out with respect to socioeconomic status. So that means not race, not country of origin, not ethnic background, but socioeconomic status.
Trudy, I'm thinking of the children that don't make it to your office.
Yes,
you know,
the
and especially poor kids that whose parents may not be taking them for their baby checkups.
Well, fortunately, I think in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, we're pretty good at outreach, and so that for parents to have the WIC program, which is the Women, mm-hmm. Infants, Children's Program for Food, they are required to get their immunizations and shots, and we have excellent coverage, healthcare coverage for kids. So I think we're doing a better job than we were, and we have reach out and read now in 47 sites within the 5-county area. So the chances of a child walking into any health department clinic or our large teaching institutions, Jefferson, St. Christopher's, CHOP, we all have the program available, Einstein as well, so that when they're going to a center, they're probably going to be able to get that. And the mission of the pediatricians in that context is to really talk about the books and the importance of that.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Chantel from Westchester joining us on Radio Times. Chantel, go ahead. You're on the air. Or no, it looks like we have Heidi. Is it Heidi? Heidi joining us from Bella Kinmer. I'm sorry, Heidi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, no problem. This is just a quick comment. It was automatic. It was natural for me to read to my babies, to my toddlers, right? And we read all the time, but the time before bed remains absolutely the most treasured in my memory.
Mm-hmm.
The intimacy that we developed, my rediscovery, and just the connection that we made, it's something that I miss terribly because they're 11 and 14 now, and so, you know, they read before bed on their own, and still that's what they do before bed. They realize now how I think how lucky they are. So we donate books together.
They
it's very actually difficult for them to even let go of their books. Mm-hmm. But that that level of intimacy is something that I took for granted and only now recognize how special it is.
Well, Heidi, appreciate the call to Radio Times. Trudy, you want
so
to respond?
So that's exactly what we're hoping for, is for parents to have that interaction. I had the same with my children, and the boys are now in their 20s, and they still talk about the books that we read together as children. So that's exactly what we're aiming for. Reach Out and Read does accept books, so if you're ready to part with some of those books, we will always take them. Yes, we call them gently used books, and we're happy to look at that. If you go to our website, reachoutandreadphilly.org or rorgp.org, we're happy to take books and do collections. We've had a lot of kids do book drives for us in the different school districts, particularly in the suburbs. And that is a wonderful community service project. And you're giving the gift of books to children in the inner city. That is exactly the reason we began Reach Out and Read at CHOP. We were the 10th site in the country, and that was the reason, because I had been doing that for 5 years with my boys, and it was impossible to believe that our families didn't have that experience. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Roberta, she used the word intimacy,
yeah.
You know, the kind of intimacy that she felt with her children as they were reading together.
Well, having a kid have a bath and wear their pajamas and sitting on your lap, smelling all delicious and soft, I mean, there's few sensual experiences that approximate that.
They're not against the law. No, I'm kidding.
It's just a wonderful opportunity. And I just feel bad for the parents who don't have a chance to do that. This brings me to the point that I wanted to make in response to our caller. You know that I think sometimes we don't sell play with your children and reading to your children enough from the parent point of view. Many, many parents, middle class, lower class, are stressed and have many, many demands on them. And I think we really should be telling parents that if they look at their watch even, you know, and take 10 minutes mm-hmm. when they
That's
just
exactly right.
focus on their child, whether it be prior to bedtime or whether it be when they come home from work, just 10 minutes, if they sat on the floor and either read to their child or played with
blocks
their child,
anything.
Their blood yes. pressure would go down and their stress level would go down. I was a parent too, and I remember those kinds of stressors, but we really need to sell more to parents about how this is important for them as well as their children's development.
Heidi, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call us as well, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about the importance of words in a child's life, the conversation between parent and child, and how sadly there are some gaps in this country when we look at poor children. Children, their access to words, and more middle class and more well off children. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I'm curious about, for those children that are not getting the kind of exposure that we're talking about, can they make that up? And if we're talking about the first year of life as this, you know, critical year mm-hmm. for all sorts of development going on, let's say they don't get this.
Mm-hmm.
Can you make it up in the second, third, fourth, fifth year?
Well, your environment would have to change drastically. This is why in the United States we need to implement more in the way of early interventions. There are early interventions that have been conducted in the past that show really quite amazing results. For example, the children who were in really excellent preschools are less likely to go to prison.
Mm-hmm.
They're more likely to delay the birth of their first child. They're more likely to go to college. Now, this doesn't describe, obviously, everyone in the sample, but you certainly improve people's lives with early, really good quality intervention. We know this, and there are some states that are trying to do this. And we also know that early intervention really should start in pregnancy, because mm-hmm. the nutrition, you know, the nutrition that the mother has, the expectations that the mother has about what this child will be like, we can all help to shape them in more positive directions. And if we have home visitation programs, we can help parents by modeling, as Trudy mm-hmm. does when they come to her office, what kinds of interactions are the most productive for their child's development. Indeed, we can model that there should be mm-hmm. interactions. Again, because mm-hmm. if you are highly stressed and you have two jobs, et cetera, talking to the baby may not be your first priority. So if we can get into people's homes more or have them come to centers more to see the kinds of things that will promote their children's development, I think we can make a big difference, because the research to support this is out there. We know these kinds of programs work.
Well, I would think, Trudy, getting into someone's home, I mean, yes. obviously with their permission, but there's so much you can learn about a child's life, a family's life.
Yes, and we do some home visits as well as part of our program, particularly in the medically complex kids. And so I just want to mention the special needs children are also part of this conversation. They also benefit from this earlier intervention mm-hmm. service and the connectivity with the parents. So it's very important. Mm-hmm. I think what we're really trying to stress is that we only have this very vulnerable time. Some people talk about 1,000 days, some 2,000 days, basically, with that child to really encourage the synapses to grow. The nervous system is burgeoning in the first 2-3 years of life, and you miss that window, and you have neurons being pruned back. And so that's really what we're after, is to teach families how important is that stimulation in those first couple of years are. Yes, can you make it up? Yes, and we have lots of programs, and Head Start makes a huge difference, but the sooner you start, the better off the child will be, no question. Even our economist, James Heckman, has done amazingly elegant research. He's a Nobel Prize-winning economist who's really talked about the amount of dollars you invest in the early childhood years is more than returned versus a later child when you're remediating.
Right. So Heckman talks about front-loading versus back-loading. So if you invest in the early interventions, you reduce the amount you spend on prisons. We have a ridiculous number of people in prisons in this country. Mm. So there are many things that we can do to magnify the kinds of experiences that children have. And even Heckman, in his latest research cited in the New York Times, has argued that we aren't beginning early enough, that we really do need to begin in infancy. The other thing I have to say is we sink or swim together in America. And I think that there are a lot of people who think, oh, you know, these poor people, we can never change them. But, you know, we are a nation that has had tremendous impact around the world and has uplifted immigrants who've come from everywhere. And I think it's so important for us to recognize that we sink or swim together. And we need to create a workforce for tomorrow that can meet the challenges. And the only way we can do that is by educating our children.
Right. Go ahead, Trudy.
I'll give an anecdote. I have now been giving out books for 16, almost 17 years to children. And I have now teenagers who've come back, and we just celebrate our 15th anniversary of giving out books at CHOP in particular, and these two girls I followed throughout their life, and the mom came and found me the day they got into Magnet High Schools and said specifically that this was because you gave them books and I read to
Yay.
Them.
Right. Yeah,
and so it is one person at a time, but I can tell you that children, you give them books and you forget which book you gave, they'll say, Dr. Hecker, I already have that book. And you say, I've won. We've made, changed a life. And so that's what this interaction is all about, getting language, getting a change.
If you don't mind, let me just get another caller or two. It looks like we have Suzanne from Germantown joining us on Radio Time. Suzanne, go ahead. You're on the air. That would be, yes. There we go. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. I'm a speech-language pathologist. I work in Philadelphia in early intervention and in the schools, and there's two things that I've noticed. One is that often kids are referred into the system later, and they've taken their kids to the pediatrician. The pediatrician has not referred, and that's often frustrating. Yes. And then the second piece is actually going into the homes, birth to three especially. Yes. You know, I'm in there. I get it. I'm a mom, too. Yes. I get how difficult it can be to get on the floor and actually play with your kids when you're stressed and you've got a million things going on. Yes. And so often when parents have these therapists coming into the homes, they see it as their opportunity to take a break. And if you suggest otherwise, they get offended or upset. And again, I can understand, like, oh, somebody's coming into my house to take care of my children for an hour. But that's not the job of the therapist. It's to get the family involved. And that's a really challenging piece.
Well, I'm glad you called, Suzanne. Yes. Again, both of our guests vigorously nodding their heads. Go ahead, Trudy.
Yes, well, I applaud you for your work. You're doing a great job. I have most of my patients are in early intervention. You know, part of the difficulty is it's 25% delay to get into early intervention. But our goal with, you know, all this conversation is to really teach our residents. We have 140 residents. We're really trying to teach them the importance of speech language and the difficulties and delays and making sure that we don't just pass over it. The American Academy of Pediatrics recently has talked about toxic stress and what that means. So there's a whole front page of their website on what toxic stressors are and what that means to children. And I think we're trying to make everyone much more aware I applaud you for going out there, and I think, you know, it's not, I have lots of patients who've had early intervention for years, and it does make a difference. So please, please don't feel too soured by that. Parents do absorb what you're giving them, no question.
Suzanne, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Yeah, go ahead, Roberta.
So if I could build on what Trudy said and just define toxic stress. So you can imagine that seeing repeated episodes of violence, whether it's children who are siblings who are fighting in really nasty ways or parents fighting, things like that, that really get your blood going and put you in a great state of arousal, cause the release of a stress hormone called cortisol. And when this happens repeatedly, what it does is it has an impact on your brain. And your brain is much more likely to respond to stressful circumstances by releasing cortisol. And this means that you're going to have a lifelong proclivity to respond negatively in situations that are difficult for you, and also possibly the likelihood that you will have mental health issues when you get older. So it is so important that people like you are getting to go into homes, and even if the parent isn't paying close attention to you, if the parent is overhearing, and then if you can point out later some of the things that you did that could be helpful to do, I would hope that most of the parents would be receptive to this. In my experience, every parent wants their child to exceed them. Every parent wants their child to do better than they did. And I think sometimes we have to talk to parents that way and help them understand that sometimes the cultural beliefs that they have may work against that. Like, children should be seen and not heard is something that even I heard as a kid, although I babbled quite a bit. But, you know, that's not the way we need to rear our children today.
Well, you know what? We're going to end on that note. We are out of time. Suzanne, thank you for the call to Radio Times. And Roberta Golenkoff and Trudy Hecker, thank you very much as well. Trudy Hecker, a pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, medical director of Reach Out and Read. Roberta Golenkoff, director of the Infant Language Project at the University of Delaware. Thank you both very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank
You're very welcome. Heather Bromfield, the intern for Radio Times today. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. Megan Pinto helping us out today. Radio Times produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Bilder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can learn much more about this program.